My name is Tom Miersman. I work for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis as an environment and energy reporter. This panel is the aquatic invasive species. We're going to look at them basically in terms of we're going to kind of divide the panel in half. A couple people are going to talk mainly about ballast-related issues, species that come in through ballast tanks of large ships and get spread around by shipping industry primarily. But it's certainly not the only way that aquatic invasive species get into our waterways and spread. The other two folks are going to address those issues more in terms of Asian carp, maybe zebra mussels, things that have gotten into the river systems either through other means or through the Great Lakes and are now spreading through the rivers. There's one change to the program. Rich Everett, who's a senior scientist with the Coast Guard, is listed on the program. He is the father of two young children who came down with the flu. And Richard emailed me yesterday saying he couldn't get on a flight because he also now has the flu. But we have an able person who's joining the panel who's not on your program. It's kind of classy, isn't it? You know?
They're communicators.
Yeah. All we need next is air horns or something, I think, you know. There's probably some around here at Madison, I'm sure, with the lively college, their university that's here. Our first speaker is going to be Jeff Alexander, and he can tell you more about himself. He's going to give sort of an overview. After that, Marc Gagnon will talk. He is from Montreal. He represents some major shipping folks up there and has been active in this for a good long time. Marc will be followed by Cindy Kolar, who works for USGS and was based for a good long time in La Crosse, Wisconsin, now is in the D.C. area, has a lot of information about Asian carp and has been talking to some of the scientists there about the latest in terms of where they are and what they're noticing about how they're affecting the ecology. And Phil Moy is going to be our final speaker, and he's going to talk about Asian carp as well and other issues, but specifically a human-made dispersion barrier in the Chicago Ship and Sanitary Canal, which is designed to try to keep them from getting from the river system into the Great Lakes, into Lake Michigan in particular, and other related things, but he spent a lot of time on that. So without further ado, I'm going to have Jeff lead off, and we'll run through this. We'll try to have plenty of time for questions and answers at the end, so we'll probably hold it till the end in terms of if you have some questions. One other quick thing is that the best I can do for you in terms of the Coast Guard is they put out a press release a couple weeks ago which notices the fact that they are proposing a ballast water standard, and they're having public meetings around the country. So this press release doesn't give you that much information about the nature of the standard, but it does give you the date and citation in the Federal Register where you could look that up. And it also tells some of the meetings have been done already, but others are yet to come. And you can use this and the contact information on it to try to get more information, give you a head start in terms of if you're researching this. So it's the best I can do in terms of having some information about what they're up to, because this is an active thing. Some folks are covering it as news around the country, and it certainly should be something that I think maybe our speakers might even refer to it a little bit, but Coast Guard can speak for themselves. Anyway, this will give you a starting point to try to see what this is more and learn more about it. So, Jeff, please go ahead, and thanks for coming.
Good morning. Just a little bit of background about me. I was environmental reporter in Michigan for about 25 years until May when I left to join the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes office. I wrote the book that's on the back table back there. It's called Pandora's Locks, The Opening of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway, which looks at how opening the seaway 50 years ago accidentally invited biological mayhem into the Great Lakes. So my talk will be sort of focusing on how the seaway, you know, inadvertently unleashed this biological plague in the lakes, how it could have been prevented, and why it wasn't. So for background, the seaway is a series of locks and canals between Lake Ontario and Montreal. It opened in 1959, and it allowed ocean freighters to come into the Great Lakes for the first time. The idea was to increase commerce in the region, which it did, connected the Great Lakes shipping system to the global shipping system. It didn't meet that goal of increasing commerce, but when ships brought commerce to the Great Lakes from around the world, they often brought ballast water. And an unloaded ocean freighter can carry as much as 3 million gallons of ballast water, which we later learned could teem with aquatic life. And I apologize, I have to fly through this in 10 minutes. Tom's got me under strict orders. So in 1960s, we started to see these foreign species popping up in the Great Lakes. The initial discoveries didn't cause much alarm. 1972, Congress passed what became known as the Clean Water Act, and that law actually regulated ballast water discharges. So without realizing it, Congress had solved what is now one of the biggest environmental problems in the Great Lakes. The following year, the EPA, without consulting Congress, decided that it didn't want to deal with ballast water, determined without doing much science that it was not a serious environmental threat to waters, and issued a blanket exemption, which allowed ships from around the world to discharge unlimited quantities of ballast water into any U.S. waters. 1981, the Canadians commissioned a study of ocean freighters coming into the Great Lakes. They checked 55 ships in Montreal and found just an enormous number of foreign species in the ballast water. You can see the numbers up there. The conclusion, there was no doubt that these ships were bringing in phenomenal numbers of foreign species. So this was the response. The U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards were given the report, and they both did nothing. They decided it wasn't conclusive. So in the 1980s, things really started to get ugly. We had the spiny water flea come in, Eurasian ruff, zebra mussels, quagga mussels, round gobies. And the zebra mussel was the big discovery in 1988. 1989, zebra mussel shut down the city of Monroe's water system in southern Michigan. That really got everyone's attention. Canada instituted voluntary guidelines for ballast water exchange, which in the simplest form, it just asked shippers to exchange ballast water in the North Atlantic before they came into the St. Lawrence River. So they would flush out whatever ballast water they had in their tanks with ocean water. The theory being that if there were any freshwater species in their ballast tanks, they would be flushed out. And then if they happened to bring in any saltwater species, those would die in the Great Lakes anyway. It was a good approach. Congress followed suit in the U.S. the next year, and then they made this mandatory in 1993. So beginning in 1993, every ship that came into the Great Lakes from overseas that was destined for a U.S. port was required to exchange ballast water in the North Atlantic and flush its ballast tanks. Unfortunately, the Coast Guard early on ran into a problem with the regulation, and that was that 80 to 85% of the ships that came in to the Great Lakes were fully loaded with cargo. And if a ship is loaded with cargo, it doesn't have much, if any, ballast water on board. So the Coast Guard determined that if there wasn't a pumpable amount of ballast water in the tanks, a ship was given a free pass. Well, that sounded okay, but the average ship, and these are ships called nobobs for no ballast on board, the average nobob carried about 150 metric tons of muddy slop in its ballast tanks. So this muddy slop, like the ballast water, was very rich with aquatic species and numerous pathogens, E. coli, cholera, cryptosporidium, pretty serious concern. So a ship would come in loaded with cargo. It wouldn't have any ballast water, but it would have this mud in its tanks. It would come into, say, Cleveland. It would offload cargo. It would take on ballast water. It would go to another Great Lakes port. Meanwhile, this ballast water had mixed with this mud. The next time they discharged ballast water, the mud went with it, usually into the Great Lakes. So in 1 year, 1995, almost 1 billion gallons of ballast water/mud was discharged into the Great Lakes. So Congress was frustrated by the Coast Guard's inability to deal with this problem, so they passed a tougher law in 1996, which just reinstated that every ship should be exchanging ballast water in the North Atlantic before it came into the Great Lakes. And the Coast Guard still didn't enforce the law. And this comment from a congressman in Michigan, Congressman Vern Ehlers, he knows this ballast water issue as well as anyone in Congress. He's a conservative Republican, a physicist by training, and his comment is pretty telling. If you can't see it, he said, I personally think the Coast Guard really fell down on the job. Congress passed a law on invasive species in 1990, and the Coast Guard did nothing. Congress passed another law in 1996, and the Coast Guard did nothing. They really didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't see it as part of their mission, and they tended to side with the shipping industry. So this is a slide from 1989. The red dots are showing all the confirmed discoveries of zebra mussels, 1989. This is 20 years later. The red dots are zebra mussels. The green dots are quagga mussels. And you'll notice quagga mussels are in California. Zebra mussels are in 23 states and two Canadian provinces. This has become a huge continental issue. This is not a regional issue or a national issue. It's a continental issue. And these are some of the effects. This is a comparison of the number of quagga mussels. And quagga mussels are basically the bigger, meaner brothers of zebra mussels. In 2000, there were hardly any quagga mussels in Lake Michigan. 2005, huge numbers. Latest count, there were 500 million pounds of quagga mussels in Lake Michigan. And here's the other side of the story. This little guy here, Diaparia, was once the most abundant source of fish food in the Great Lakes, lives on the bottom of the lakes. And as quagga mussels came in and colonized the lakes, Diaparia is essentially vanished. This is happening in Lake Huron as well. And then one of the really strange things, these mussels increase water clarity, which increases the amount of algae that grows on the lake bottom. And on the shores of Lake Ontario, we've seen these algae blooms break off and clog the water intakes of nuclear power plants, forcing emergency shutdowns. Think of China syndrome on the Great Lakes. These plants are built to deal with emergency shutdowns. Their staff are trained to deal with it. But the worst case scenario, if you lose your cooling water, you have a nuclear meltdown. So this is sort of a short summary of the consequences. The Seaway did increase commerce in the region, but it also turned the Great Lakes into North American beachhead for invasives that have spread across the continent. The ships brought in 57 invasive species. They now cause, at latest estimate, between $200 and $400 million a year in damage. Zebra mussels alone have caused at least $1 billion damage. Zebra mussels are spreading one of the worst problems across the country, and that is wherever zebra mussels invade, toxic algae blooms tend to follow. So in Michigan, we're seeing these toxic algae blooms arise in some of the cleanest lakes in the state due to zebra mussels. And this will be a story if you are from any part of the country or Canada and you have zebra mussels in your lakes, you should be looking at this as a news story. And the bottom line, in my estimation, this is the conclusion of my book, that this problem of ocean freighters bringing foreign species into the Great Lakes will cause more damage than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So was this preventable? Yes. The regulations were in place in 1972. The warning signs were clear in 1981. We passed laws in 1990 and 96 that weren't enforced. Finally, in 2006, the Canadian side of the St. Lawrence Seaway, because the Seaway is jointly owned by the U.S. and Canada, the Canadian side said, this is enough of this. We need to require every ship that comes in to flush their ballast tanks with seawater. And then the U.S. followed suit last year. This is a great thing because it covers these no-bops. So every single ship that comes into the Great Lakes now is at least doing what they call a swish and spit, where they're bringing in a small amount of ocean water, flushing the tanks, and then discharging it into the North Atlantic before they come into the Great Lakes. This is what should have happened in 1993. So this is just a little bit of talk about the solutions. And this the swish and spit that's now required, the early science indicates that it eliminates between 95 and 98% of all species in the ballast tanks. Oops, I went too far. Can you go back one?
Okay.
So I'll leave it there.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. We're going to move on quickly to Mark, who has been working on this issue for more than 20 years. He represents the shipping industry and has some thoughts about what they're doing, what they're thinking about, what they're actually doing, and some of the methods to try to actually get this issue not exactly solved, but significantly reduced. So please, Mark, go ahead and have at it.
Thank you, Tom. Now we're the bad guys here. We were the bad guys. I'll refer to what Jeff has said a few times. I couldn't resist but to talk to you about FedNav a little bit, our company. We're a Canadian company based in Montreal, the largest dry bulk shipping group in Canada. Not a large amount of employees, only less than 300, but a lot of seafarers on our ships. We are mostly a ocean-going international shipping company, but we also operate 9 marine terminals, 5 in the Great Lakes and 4 in the U.S. East Coast, and we have different other divisions. We are the largest international Great Lakes operator. It means our ships are red, so if you see red ships, that's ours. The salties, as we call them, the international or ocean-going ships, are not the majority of ships in the Great Lakes. Of course, the first the U.S. Lakers and then the Canadian Lakers, but of the ocean-going ships, we have about 50%. 26 million tons carried in 2008. We operate ships all over the world. We own just 22 ships, 20 ocean-going vessels, and 2 high Arctic class vessels that go into the Canadian Arctic. Those are Canadian flagged, and we operate about 60 more vessels on a long-time charter. I like photos of ships, so this is the looks of our ships. What goes into the lakes are handicized or multipurpose is because they have box holes and can carry things like steel coils and general cargo, but also bulk. It's mainly bulk. We have a few Handymax or Supermax, just a little bigger. We just operate 1 or 2 Panamaxes. We don't operate Cape Size or Aframax, so we deal with smaller ships. And like everybody else, this has been a very difficult year. Now, let's go to ballast water. This is taken from Globalist, the IMO, International Marine Organization website about ballast water. This is the simple way it works. I mean, we need ballast. We need ballast because it enables the ship to be stable, to have sufficient draft, and to keep its structural integrity. If we don't carry ballast, our ships will capsize, our ship will break in two. It happens all the time. It is very important. We cannot deal without ballast. There are a few innovation about some no ballast ship, but it's not in the mainstream. It's some ships carry more ballast than others. Container ship carry very little ballast. U.S. Laker carry a lot of ballast. So on a typical FedNav ship, we have 16 ballast tanks, 3 pumps, a capacity of 20,000 cubic meters or 5 million U.S. gallons. And on a typical U.S. Laker, you have 14 million U.S. gallons. So it's a lot of water, but those bigger ships carry a lot more. Tanks are everywhere, as you can see in the diagram, mostly on the double hull, double bottom, and between the hull and the holds. but these are, it's not big holes, the ballast tanks, it's within the structural component of the ship. So when Jeff was talking about no-bobs, when we don't carry any ballast water, there is mud a little everywhere. That's why we need flushing. This diagram, as you can see, is pretty simple. When we discharge cargo, we're taking ballast, and then when we load cargo, we unload ballast. Now, the typical voyage is not like that. Let's say a typical voyage from St. Petersburg to Cleveland. We do that a lot. We will load cargo in St. Petersburg in the Baltic Sea, and we'll discharge ballast water in the Baltic Sea. We will do in the middle of the Atlantic a saltwater flushing because we're no bob, and we'll be checked in St. Lambert in Montreal by the either Transport Canada or the U.S. Coast Guard. Now, they inspect every tank of every ship that goes there. There's not one tank that they don't like port state control. When, you know, you're a good operator, they say, that's okay, we know you. No, in Montreal, they check everything. And if your tank is not 30 ppt salinity, 30 parts per thousand, they seal the tank. So you cannot discharge what is in this tank. So we then go up to Cleveland, we unload the cargo, so we take ballast water indeed in Cleveland, and then we go to Duluth, for instance, or Superior to load, because Superior is the biggest load port for international shipping in the lakes, and so we discharge ballast water in Duluth. That's why Duluth is the biggest discharge port in the Great Lakes. And we go back. Sometimes we'll stop in the St. Lawrence to top off, and we go, say, to Antwerp to unload. It is very rare that one of our ships will go into the lakes empty. Extremely rare, because, you know, of the economics of it. So if we do that, then it'll be full of ballast water. But as I said, we don't do that often. Next one, well, you've seen a few. These are a few others. Well, the zebra mussel, it's a round goby. And the last one is not in the lakes. It's in the St. Lawrence. It's the Chinese mitten crab. So it's not in the lakes because it's a saltwater species. Now, we know that, of course, we acknowledge that AIS is a real, very difficult, very tragic, if I may say, problem in the Great Lakes, and we know we're, you know, partly responsible for it. I say partly because, of course, there's more species since 1959, the opening of the seaway, but we are responsible for about 40% of the introduction of invasive species. So we're not the only one. There's a lot from aquaculture or fishing or aquariums and whatnot, but we are responsible, not FedNAF, but the international shipping community, for 40% of the introduction. So what are we doing about that? First, what Jeff explained, two things, important things, the ballast water exchange and the salt water flushing. We do the same, it's the same operation in the middle of the Atlantic, 200 miles from the coast, in 2,000 meters of ocean. We don't have the choice. It's the regulation. FedNAV has been doing that for decades now, but now it's the regulation for everybody. So as I said, we have to. But we do that even though if we stop in, say, Sept-Îles or Quebec City or Montreal, we do the same thing. If we go to Baltimore or to California, we do the same thing. We always exchange our ballast water in the ocean. And that's the now the practice, and salt water flushing for our no-bob ships. Now, what's next? This is next, the treatment systems. These are three. The one on your left is the Alfa Laval. The one in the center is the RWO, is a South Korean system, and the one on the right is the local one, is Hyde Gordon. It's from Cleveland here. 25 different systems are in development now. 24 different companies are developing ballast water treatment systems because it's going to be the regulation. 8 have received final approval from the IMO, and 6 have received type approval from the flag state. So we're going there. It's coming, and it's there's still a few problems, one of which is freshwater. I hesitate to say none of those systems work in freshwater, because some do, but the High Gordon, the company says that it works in freshwater but not in Duluth. I don't know why, because it's a lot of sediment there, and it's a UV system. Anyway, they are saying that. So it's still a problem. And the other problem is very few ships have a functioning system right now. So we have some on our ships for testing, but not a lot. It's very rare that you will find a system. My last slide is the problem that we have with and we'll be having with the regulatory regime. We're extremely pleased that the Coast Guard has produced its standard. We cannot be more pleased than that, because what we need, why do not we install systems right now? Because of consistency. We need to be sure that the system that will cost a few million dollars each on each of our ship will work everywhere we go. So that's why we're not doing anything, because we don't know. The states have all the different rules. We want to be sure that the U.S. has the same rule as the rest of the world. So once we have that, once we have consistency. By the way, the international regime is by 2012, all new ships will be equipped with a system. And by 2016, after the first dry dock, all existing vessels will need to have a treatment system on board. So, in conclusion, a very real problem. We're trying to deal with that. I just want to correct Jeff about one thing. New invaders are not getting in, because the last... It doesn't. I don't want to say that it's finished, because it takes time to discover new species. But the last species discovered was in December 2006, the red bloody shrimp or something like that. So what we're doing seems to be effective. With treatment system, it will be solved. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. There's, I'm sure, plenty of questions we could pitch just at the ballast part of this, but we're going to switch quickly to the broader question of invasive species get into systems in other ways than ships as well, and the next two speakers will address that, starting with Cindy.
Thank you, and thanks for the invitation to come and speak today. Invasive species in the Great Lakes, such an important issue for the ecosystem. And it's difficult to talk about the ecology of the Great Lakes and not include a discussion of invasive species. And these days, I would say the discussion would be dominated by the importance of invasive species in the functioning of the ecosystem. And some things we can look to, there's lots of examples to choose from, but some relatively new changes in the Great Lakes would be a shift in the store of energy from the water column, the form of plankton, to the bottom, the benthic region, because of the continuous filtration by zebra and quagga mussels, restructuring of the zooplankton community from predation by bathytrethes, which is the spiny water flea, and increases in mortality and scarring wound rates on salmonids from predation by sea lamprey. But there's plenty of other things you could pick. Invasive species are certainly a big problem in the Great Lakes. So today we heard a lot about ballast water, and depending on how you count, between 50% and 70% of non-native species that are reproducing in the lakes now were introduced through commercial ship-mediated vector in some way. So it's certainly an important vector that hopefully the regulations will help to address, and maybe we'll have more time and energy to spend on, you know, this other 30% to 50% vectors by which 30% to 50% have entered the lakes. And these sorts of vectors include deliberate introductions, certainly true for fish, mostly historically, stocking by federal and state agencies and other management authorities, unintended introductions, so, you know, somebody out there, unauthorized, so it could either be by bait bucket or escapes from aquaculture pet releases, that sort of thing. A lot of fish especially have come in from outlying areas, so they're found in other watersheds and were connected either by canals, or maybe it was a non-native species introduced to the continent that became established and was able to get into the Great Lakes that way, or through activities associated with recreational boating. There are other vectors also, but those are probably the most important ones after ballast water introduction anyway. And so today what I'm going to talk about is some research that USGS has ongoing regarding species that were introduced through ballast water and, you know, so dumped in the lakes, and then also like kind of switching gears and looking at some species that were introduced in the outlying areas and that are on their way to the Great Lakes. And those would be the Asian carps, bighead and silver carp. That can be a segue to what Phil is going to be talking to us about. Okay, so ballast water introductions. The species with the longest history of research in the Great Lakes and this USGS in this area would be zebra and quagga mussels. And when the introduction happened, or when they were discovered over 20 years ago, those researchers were part of the Fish and Wildlife Service. The same people have been involved throughout the invasion. And the sort of research that was done looked at the monitoring, looking at the distribution, the population size, characteristics of the biology and reproduction out in the field, and along with laboratory experiments. And so recently I talked to Don Schlosser, who is at our Great Lakes Science Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he confirmed that, sure, zebra mussels are continuing to be replaced by quagga mussels, it's the better competitor of the two species, and they keep finding them in deeper and deeper areas in the lake. Quagga mussels up to about 100 meters now, and when they're out trawling for fish, you know, dragging a net across the bottom of the substrate, they can bring up to a ton of quagga mussels per trawl. And so this has impacts not only for the Great Lakes, but also for the westward invasion of quagga mussels in particular. And as Jeff mentioned, in early 2007, quagga mussels were found in Lake Mead, Hoover Dam, and Lake Havasu, which is the primary source for municipal and agricultural water for Southern California and Phoenix. And since that time, they've spread through some through canals and associated waterways. There's been some zebra mussels out in Colorado also, but the big problem is quagga mussels. And this renewed interest in coming up with ways to control, especially quagga mussels, and especially in hydroelectric facilities and ways to convey water from one place to another, since this is so important out west. And we have some researchers at the Upper Midwest Environmental Sciences Center in La Crosse, Wisconsin, who are working with a private company called Advanced Bionutrition, and are looking to see if a relatively new technology developed for something completely different could be applied to control zebra and quagga mussels. And it's kind of a neat thing. It was something that was developed for people, for like bioactive yogurt cultures and to deliver vitamins, where you don't want the good thing you want your body to absorb to be deactivated too soon. So they had to come up with a way to encapsulate the good stuff and then have some, you know, once it hit where you wanted it to become active, you know, there was a way to turn it on. And so it's kind of like doing that, but instead of delivering something good, it would be delivering something bad to the zebra quagga mussels. And potassium chloride, a salt, is very toxic to dry cynids, zebra and quagga mussels. And so our researchers are working with this company to see if they can come up with a way to encapsulate the potassium chloride and have the zebra mussel ingest it and then have something activate it and cause the mussel to die. So they're looking for things that are unique, you know, different between the introduced species and our native species. And it's, you know, something like a molecule in the mucus or pH of the gut or something, looking for some difference that will help and make this a viable control method. And that sort of technology could also be used to control Asian carps. Both bighead and silver carp have their filter feeders. They take out zooplankton and phytoplankton from the water, and so they have a bunch of mucus that covers their gills. So there's a chance that this sort of thing could also be used. We can add to the water and control the particle size and control which fish species are bringing it in, and hopefully we can come up with something to target killing bighead and silver carp. Okay, which brings me to kind of switching gears and looking at what USGS is doing, or some of what we're doing with the Asian carps. So bighead and silver carp were introduced to the country in the 70s. They were brought over on purpose from China and other places in Asia. They were brought to by municipalities to improve water quality and water treatment ponds, and also by aquaculturalists for food for people and to improve the water quality in their ponds. And after they were brought over, they escaped from the various places they were introduced and became established and in the interior of the country. And since that time, especially in the past 10 years, 8-10 years, they've spread rapidly and become quite abundant. And we have a lab in Columbia, Missouri, the Columbia Environmental Science Center, and they're pretty much at the centroid of the introduction. And so we have fisheries biologists there who've been monitoring the population and looking at different aspects of the biology and ecology of these fish since they were introduced. Dwayne Chapman is the researcher who heads up that research. And they've got a lot of studies going on. They find out a lot of interesting things. But what they're finding now is that especially the bighead carp are kind of in trouble right now. Last year, these fish would spawn every time from April all the way through summer. Anytime the river would come up a little bit, increased water flow causes bighead and silver carp to come and spawn. And last year, they could sample for larval fish anytime after rain. A few days later, they'd find baby fish. This year, they found no evidence of reproduction anywhere that they've been typically sampling over the past several years. Big news. And he said that the bighead and silver carp are in very poor condition. And condition factor is a weight relative to length measurement. So they've gotten skinnier. He says they don't look good. And it used to be the most abundant fish he dealt with was bighead carp. And he's having a hard time finding the minimum number he needs just to get length and weight so he can characterize the population. And he can't find evidence. You know, he looks at dissect fish, can't find gonads that are ready for spawning, and he said the flesh is not looking good. It's translucent, which means the nutrients are gone. So this is at the centroid of the invasion. This is not true of fish throughout the areas that have been invaded. Definitely populations are growing, especially towards the north because there's more room in the country to go that way. But where they've been the longest and have been the most abundant, it looks like they're just not doing well this year. In terms of effects on native species, very hard to show in riverine fish. It's surprising how little we know about zooplankton cycling, you know, the population structure throughout different habitat types and throughout the year in large rivers. And so the fish populations they can come and go pretty quickly. You can have good years and bad years. But condition factor of gizzard shad, which is a very important forage fish in the river, is certainly down. He said that's the only one he wanted to talk about in particular. There's also the scientists at UMESC that are working with the probiotic sort of technology, hoping that they can work on bighead and silver carp also. Let's see. Oh, I think that's pretty much. So we've got efforts coming from both sides. And USGS has a whole bunch more going on. And if you want to know something about the researchers, if you want to contact the researchers I talked about, or you have other questions about USGS, you can email me, and I'm ckolar@usgs.gov.
Thank you, Cindy.
Jeff showed a map of the zebra mussels and how they've spread over the years. You could have a similar map for Asian carp, which started more in the southern regions and have been spreading up the river system, the Mississippi River system in particular. And they're kind of knocking on the door of the Great Lakes right now, and Phil can tell us a lot more about that.
Yeah. So Cindy talked about the introduction of these fish back in the 70s and their escape from aquaculture facilities. They've been spreading now upstream into the Mississippi River and then branching off into the Illinois. They've made their way up into this Des Plaines region that you can see here on the map. If you follow the Des Plaines downstream, it would connect with the Kankakee, forming the Illinois River, which then goes down into the Mississippi River. So what I want to tell you about today is the development of the dispersal barrier on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And to do that, I want to start off with a little bit of history about the waterway, just as Jeff did on the St. Lawrence Seaway. So prior to 1858, the Chicago River flowed into Lake Michigan, and the Grand Calumet and the Calumet River also flowed into Lake Michigan. They were separated from from the Des Plaines River by a low subcontinental divide, just a big hill, basically about 15 feet high. After 1858, with the construction of the I&M Canal and later of the Chicago-Sanitary and Ship Canal in addition to the Calcite Channel, that continental divide was breached, and that reversed the flow of the Chicago River out of Lake Michigan, and the Calumet goes out of Lake Michigan, and all this then goes downstream down into the Illinois River. This was done primarily to improve the water quality for Chicago's drinking water. The I&M was built for cargo, and then they found that by pumping water into it, the downtown water didn't smell as bad, and some of that those carcasses were getting pumped away, cow carcasses mostly. So today we have locks at the mouth of the Chicago River, down here near the mouth of the Calumet River, and at Lockport. Now, back in 1996, the Rough Control Committee, the Eurasian Rough is a small Eurasian fish that is brought in by these guys in ballast water. And it was the Rough Control Committee identified the Chicago River, the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal, as a possible way for the Rough to get out of the Great Lakes and go downstream into the Mississippi Basin. So they, working with the Corps and the Congress developed a proposal under the National Invasive Species Act that said, Corps of Engineers, you'll develop and look into the possibility of constructing a dispersal barrier for aquatic nuisance species in the Sanitary Ship Canal. Working with a group of people, we identified that there are essentially five entrances into this system. So with a limited amount of money to invest, we looked down here at this choke point where all the water has to go through and said, well, this is the place where we'll invest the money and try to develop this dispersal barrier. There are several parallel canals there now. Here in this is a picture from 1900. The Sanitary Ship Canal is just being constructed, and you can see here the I&M Canal essentially paralleling it right along this side. So a lot of waterways just running together there. This is what the area looks like today, a much more industrialized. The canal has been filled. It's about 165 feet wide and 25 feet deep. So the first of these barriers that was constructed back in 2002 was just downstream of this natural gas pipeline. It's operated by a control building. My wife is pointing at it there. And the electrodes run across the bottom of the canal, and they generate an electric field all the way through the 25-foot water column. And this is what the electrodes look like there. The intent of the electric field is not to kill fish, but really to repel them. So we're looking at stopping fish from both directions. We have a fish approaching from either upstream or downstream. It gets near the edge of this electric field and goes back the other way. It's just uncomfortable to them rather than really hitting them really hard and stunning them. I suppose if they pushed really hard and got into this, they'd get stunned and would flow back downstream. Well, Congress and the Corps liked that idea. It looked like it was working. We've had pretty good success with the 132 tagged common carp, with only one ever having passed through the barrier, and that was at the same time that a barge passed through. So we looked at improving this, making it much larger, much bigger. Currently, we have in place barrier 2A. There will be two separate arrays of 42 electrodes each instead of just 13. 2A is operational. It went into operation spring of this year. We have the electrodes laid for barrier 2B and are waiting on construction of the control house for 2B. Now, this barrier can be turned up to a little higher voltage so it can actually stun the fish if need be. So we're waiting on that. So what I wanted to talk to you about today are some of the current challenges facing us in terms of the Asian carp having moved up a lot closer to the barrier site, and kind of these cross connections between these waterways. For 13 years, we've really focused on the sanitary and ship canal and its connections up here with Lake Michigan, running down through Lockport down into the Des Plaines River. And certainly this is the primary corridor for these fish to move up into Lake Michigan. But as you saw in that earlier slide from 1900, the I&M Canal is really quite close to the sanitary and ship canal, and it also parallels the Des Plaines River. And what we've found, we've known about the presence of these culverts, but now with the Asian carp truly knocking at the door down here, they've found a physical specimen of Asian carp down here right at this confluence and at the mouth of the I&M Canal. There are culverts up here that the city of Lamont uses to discharge stormwater from the I&M Canal into the sanitary and ship canal. So that forms this sort of between the waterways connections that if a fish swam up through all this stuff, and it's not a very nice waterway anymore, not that it really ever was if you figure they're pumping raw sewage and animal carcasses into it, but there's a lot of cattails in this area. But conceivably, in high water, a fish could get up there, bypass this barrier location, and get dumped in through these culverts into the sanitary and ship canal. So that's one concern. Another concern, probably a greater concern, is that during periods of high flow or essentially a rain event, much like we had back here in September of last year, the Des Plaines River flows over its banks down into the sanitary and ship canal. That's about six locations here and one location way up here. And that total distance along there is about 7 miles. So this is, again, we can have a fish come in here into the Des Plaines River. They've bypassed the barrier. We get a torrential rain or a period of rain over a series of days. The Des Plaines River floods, comes overland, and the fish can fall into the sanitary and ship canal or Chicago River and make its way up into the lake unimpeded. Now, we've known about these cross connections for some time, probably started talking about it in 2001 or 2002. But prior to just last fall, most of the flow over land was sheet flow, so like a lot like water running off of a parking lot, very shallow. You really would have a hard time thinking that a fish could get through that. With this 50-year rain event we had last September, that water was 3 and 4 feet deep in some spots, so it would be quite easy for a fish that's up in this area to overflow into the Cal Sag and bypass the barrier. So a huge concern there. We also have the Corps of Engineers have been working with Cindy Kolar's alma mater at Notre Dame, working with David Lodge, who's developed a really innovative technique that samples fish DNA in the water column. Now, despite having a monitoring program going on with electrofishing and nets, very traditional sampling methods for 5 years, we never caught any Asian carp downstream down here. We were trying to monitor their advance upstream. Incorporating this new molecular detection method, we were able to detect Asian carp in this, it's called the Brandon Road Pool, downstream of Lockport Lock in July. That intensified our sampling efforts, and after 2 solid weeks of electrofishing, 8 hours a day, 132 hours of electrofishing, we finally saw one fish. Haven't even captured it. We just saw one fish turn right here, right at the mouth of the Des Plaines River. Now, just in August, additional samples farther upstream have found silver carp DNA in the Des Plaines River, 5 miles upstream of the barrier, so up in the area of these overflows. So this is where these flood-related cross connections are really of grave concern. If we can be one 50-year flood of rain event from these fish overflowing into the sand ship canal, our investment of $18 million in these electric barriers may have been for naught. So now we need to look at possibly closing off parts of the I&M canal. Since there's no navigation on here, we might be able to physically fill in bits of the I&M canal, continue to divert water through these culverts. We can't flood Lamont. But then, depending on where the flood flow goes downstream, we're just impeding the progress of fish upstream with earthen fill. On the Des Plaines, between the Des Plaines and the sand ships, it's a bit more complex. There's not navigation on there, but the Des Plaines does carry a lot of stormwater discharge from communities farther upstream, even up into Wisconsin. So what we're what we've recommended with the Asian Carp Response Committee was development of a berm along this 7-mile stretch that would essentially contain the floodwaters to the Des Plaines River and prevent that overland flow. So I guess in a nutshell, some of the immediate concerns. There's some other concerns with the barrier system itself, and I'll just wrap up there, Tom, and we'll go into questions.
Okay. That's covered a lot of ground. And what I want to do now is open it up to questions. We've talking about ballast water, we're talking about other systems. So the format or the kind of protocol is that journalists who especially may be writing stories should have first shot at asking questions. It's not that big of a group here, so let's get as many as we can. But if there are some journalists that want to go first, that'd be great. And identify yourself, please. And whoever is answering first maybe can repeat the question, or I'll do that if necessary because this is being taped. Please.
This question is for Jeff, and my name is Jordan Fisher-Smith. I'm a freelancer. If it doesn't bore the public here at Cape Cod, can you explain briefly why zebra mussels cause algae blooms?
Yeah, so the question was why do zebra and quagga mussels cause algae blooms?
Or I should say how.
Yeah. So zebra and quagga mussels are filter feeders. Each mussel can filter up to a liter of water per day. So they're pulling phenomenal quantities of plankton out of the water column. So their water becomes more clear, sunlight penetrates deeper, more algae grows. When the waves kick up, it rips off the lake bottom and then comes ashore.
May I answer?
Yes, please.
I think it's important to note that it's filamentous algal bloom that they're causing, that this cladophore is a filamentous algae versus that fine floating planktonic algae.
Yeah, and just one other clarification. The algae that I referred to that's sort of spreading to inland lakes across the region, this is blue-green algae. This is a different kind of algae than we're seeing in the Great Lakes. And this is what's happening is the mussels are moving into these lakes. They eat the green algae. They don't eat the blue-green algae. So the blue-green algae takes off, grows like mad, and then it forms these algae blooms. And not all of them are toxic, but there are some strains that are 100 times more toxic than cyanide. There are strains that have been found in this region that are more toxic than sarin nerve gas, which is the stuff that was used in the Tokyo subway attacks. So this stuff is potentially very serious.
Is the algae itself, the blue-green, and introduced, or is it just something that you took the lid off it?
The mussels sort of took the lid off the blue-green algae. It's always been here. It's natural.
Is it filamentous?
The blue-green is not.
No. Another question? Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Rona Cobell. I write for the Bay Journal and the Chesapeake Bay Watershed. I just was wondering if anybody on the panel about ballast water can talk about the issue in the Chesapeake Bay, because we don't really hear very much about ballast water in the Chesapeake Bay, but we do have a number of invasive species that have come in through the ballast water.
Mark?
Not really. I mean, the and I can't answer your question about Chesapeake Bay. The thing is, the reason why the IMO did what it did we'll have new regulations about that is because it's a problem everywhere, and especially in deep bays like the Chesapeake or, and of course, in the Great Lakes and in the Baltic. It's also a very important problem, but I don't know much about what kind of species we...
And as a follow-up question, if you could just clarify what these public meetings that the Coast Guard's having, what exactly are you hoping that they accomplish in terms of, you talked about a uniform standard, so you could do the ballast systems, but Jeff, if you could talk about like what you're hoping that they're going to do in terms of...
Right. So the question was what I would hope to see come out of the proposed Coast Guard regulations. You know, as I mentioned, right now, every ship that comes into the Great Lakes from overseas does a saltwater flush of its ballast tanks. That's thought to be maybe 95 to 98% effective. These Coast Guard standards would require ballast treatment systems on board ships. They would set a treatment standard so that, as Mark said, you know, shipping companies aren't going to invest in treatment systems if they don't know what they have to treat to. There's no target. So once we have the standard, then the dominoes will start to fall. Ships will be equipped with treatment systems, and the level of protection for the Great Lakes will go up significantly, and not just for the Great Lakes, but for all U.S. waters.
Yes, Bill.
If I could, I'd like to address your question about the Chesapeake Bay again. And that was the problem with Chesapeake Bay is it's not fresh water in terms of ballast water exchange. So ballast water exchange does nothing for you. So this is where the IMO treatment standards and eventually the U.S. Coast Guard treatment standards should significantly improve the or reduce the rate of introductions to Chesapeake Bay and other saltwater ports.
Okay. Yes, please.
The question is about the abundance of fish, of Asian carp in the canal. The short answer is yes. So we still have crews out there doing electrofishing in the Sanitarian Ship Canal as well as the Des Plaines River. And despite hours and hours, they haven't caught a physical specimen. You know, here we have this DNA evidence that says silver carp are there, but still no physical entity. So what we would like to do, what we've recommended is that we've asked Dave Lodge's lab to do some additional targeted eDNA sampling in the Des Plaines River and some habitat that Dwayne Chapman actually identified as looking particularly, to quote him, carpy. And then if or where those samples come back positive, then we would go back in and maybe do a small-scale intensive sampling, either maybe a seine roundup or maybe something like a cove rotenone sample, something like rotenone is a fish toxin, to really assess, you know, you would be getting everything in there to assess how abundant are the silver carp, are big head carp present, because the Lodge Lab has only recently developed the PCR markers for big head carp, so we need to assess those as well. So, yes, there's three or four agencies that are working on this together and cooperatively, as well as really looking at some drastic measures to get in there and assess the abundance and species presence.
I wanted to just follow up with a quick question of my own. A lot of what we're talking about is sort of where the frontier is with regard to how far up the river systems the carp have gone. How much south of where your map is in terms of miles, are there definite huge numbers of Asian carp kind of waiting to continue to move up?
They are more abundant about 13 miles downstream. And we have caught them there with electrofishing and nets. And we know their numbers are increasing in the Brandon Road, or the Des Plaines, Dresden Island Pool. So that's about 13 miles and two locks downstream.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just wondering if there's been any consideration of how many eggs these fish produce. From what I understand from David Hughes is that the Asian carp produce thousands and thousands of eggs. And I don't know how an electric barrier can stop those from being put. I know the Chicago River Canal flows one way, but would it be possible that eggs can be put?
A 40-pound female can produce 2.5 million eggs. They are heterosexual, so they do require male and female to reproduce. If they are able to reproduce in the Des Plaines River. They do require about 63 miles of free-flowing channel in order for the eggs to be dropped. Eggs require that float time. It's about 2 weeks or so in order to incubate, and then they have to settle out into nice side channels. Cindy literally wrote the book on this, so she can correct me if I'm wrong. But potentially, if those eggs were in the Des Plaines and they flowed over into the sanitary ship canal, they would likely get flushed downstream again before they had that ability to develop. And we're really more worried about juvenile Asian carp, like four or five, six inches, that could resist the flow and swim back upstream. So I don't think the eggs at this point are the major concern. Cindy, do you
have any? I think you got it.
Okay.
Well, the fecundity is high, up to 2.5 million eggs, but for a 40-pound female, but the high mortality rate of those. You know, so you wouldn't expect one fish to end up with, you know, a million additions to the population or something in a given year. As Phil was explaining, the eggs kind are neutrally buoyant, so they just kind of float downstream, and they kind of have to hope that they're going to hit suitable habitat when they hatch and are of a size that they start swimming and they can get to a protected area where they're going to find some food. So there can be a... I'm sorry.
The canal itself is
not good habitat for eggs. So the question was the canal good habitat for the eggs? No, the canal would not be. What happens is the eggs hatch while in stream, and so the little larvae can't swim around, and they have an egg sac, and they're kind of at the whim of the flow, and so the idea is that they kind of hope they wash into a good area, and where they can start swimming and have more control over their lives. So they need backwater areas.
Jeff wanted to ask a quick question, too.
Well, Phil and Cindy, I just wondered, you know, if the Asian carp do get into the Great Lakes, what's the latest science on what the worst-case scenario might be?
Well, Jeff, it'd be like adding 100-pound zebra mussels swimming around. Essentially, they eat the same thing as zebra and quagga mussels, plant plankton, silver carp eat plant plankton, and bighead carp eat animal plankton. They can grow, they eat 40% of their body weight a day. They can grow to 90, 100, 125 pounds is the biggest specimen we've seen out of inland lakes. So they sort of, plus they, you know, they have that nice habit of jumping out of the water and hurting people, so... the impacts could be quite large. That said, there's not that much plankton out in the middle of the Great Lakes. Most of the plankton would be concentrated in nearshore areas, river mouths, shallow productive bays like the western end of Lake Erie, maybe Green Bay, Saginaw Bay. So that might be where, if they could become established, and Cindy, what, there's 11 tributaries on the Great Lakes that could have potentially produced spawning populations. So they could become established in these areas and grow and be have the greatest impact in these shallow productive areas. Out in the middle of the lake, unless they're eating spiny water fleas or something like that, they probably won't do so well.
I mean, it sounds, just to think of it, this is a riverine fish primarily. You would think, well, the Great Lakes is not going to be a good habitat. But really, the way that the water flow is in the Great Lakes, especially around, it's kind of like a big river, and plankton moves... with the flow of water, and there is a lot of flow in the Great Lakes, and so even though these fish have been introduced all around the world, hundreds of countries have bighead and silver carp on purpose, and they like them a whole bunch because they remove them, you know, it's protein for people to eat. They haven't really been introduced in any habitat that's like the Great Lakes, and so we really don't know what's going to happen, but I think there's good reason to think that they do fairly well, and it's possible even that they wouldn't need to go into tributaries to spawn because there is a lot of flow out in the lakes. So we don't have a lot to go on to predict what they would do.
I guess the other point really that we should make is it would be an additional insult to the food web, the base of the food web. So we could have, we've already seen a decline in the growth of salmon and stock trout and our commercial whitefish species. So conceivably we could see additional reductions in productivity of the lake.
Yes?
I think sort of one of the simplistic questions to follow up with that is, have there been any discussions of closing the Chicago diversion? Obviously, there are real economic impacts.
The question was asking whether there's been any consideration to closing the sanitary and ship canal or that connection with the lake, and the answer is yes. 2 years ago, the Alliance for the Great Lakes sponsored a study that looked at what would it take to actually separate the lake from the canal and how much, what sort of economic or infrastructure impacts that would entail. Part of some of the challenges that you need to overcome, okay, commercial shipping, we can move big stuff without necessarily, sorry, Mark, putting it on a ship, but
I don't care about the ship canal.
Right,
too small for our ships. So.
Right, so but your ships could come into Lake Calumet, offload the cargo, you put it on an overland system, and you haul it over this wall. That's one challenge. The other is Chicago's disposal of its sanitary wastewater. Right now, I didn't mention it earlier, but they put about 1.3 billion gallons a day. Sanitary discharge into that canal. And they are not, unlike, say, Milwaukee or some other Great Lakes municipalities, they are not set up to discharge that into Lake Michigan to meet the water quality standards. So they're really pushing this stuff downstream. Now, that's okay, but depending on where you put that separation, some of that water might end up back in the lake, and Chicago's funny about killing its citizens. So the wastewater discharge is one problem. The stormwater discharge is another problem. They have that gigantic tarp system, but even that cannot handle all the stormwater all the time, so they get occasional backflows into the lake. So there's some pretty significant engineering hurdles to overcome. Probably we can't close it down here at Romeoville because there's an awful lot of construction material and energy and coal in that goes up into Chicago and the products that come out of Chicago. So probably the closure, when it occurs, if I can be so bold, is going to be up next to the lake, most likely. But people are seriously considering this because this solution, this electric barrier, and the maintenance that's going to be involved with it in the future, is I don't feel it's sustainable over the long term. We're going to have to go with a permanent separation.
We're going to go about five more minutes, so a couple more questions.
Wow.
I've got one for Mark. You showed us examples of technologies that are under consideration, but I don't really understand what they are. Are they going to filter ballast water? There have also been suggestions of chlorinating ballast water or subjecting it to heat or ultraviolet radiation, all kinds of stuff to try to kill anything in the ballast before it's discharged. So is there a particular method that looks most promising to you out of all those 24, 25 technologies that are out there?
Well, not really. They're indeed trying everything. So you go from the UV systems and most of them have a filtering component, but some of them is cavitation, other are biocides. Most of them, I didn't mention that to go into type approval at IMO, it's because you have a biocide component. Otherwise, like hide, they don't need to go to IMO because it's UV and filtration. Now, is that which one works best? We don't know. What's important for us is if they meet the requirements of what the IMO and now the Coast Guard is proposing, that's fine. Now we'll choose a system that's consistent, not too expensive. That we don't want to carry salt into the Great Lakes just to put into our system. Right now there's a There's the Great Ship Initiative in Superior, Wisconsin, the only test facility in fresh water, and they have piles of salt because they have to work with salt water, and these systems work with salt water. So it'll depend. We don't want to carry too much stuff into our ships to make the system work, so we'll choose the one, and other companies will do the same. But right now, we know that there are eight systems that do the job at IMO level. Not one does the job at 10 times, 100 times, or 1,000 times IMO, like the Coast Guard is suggesting for the next step, because there's no way to test those systems to go to 1,000 IMO. Now they're tested to go to IMO. So there's a variety of things that the systems do. I'm no scientist, so I cannot explain that to you. But we'll, as long as they respect the standards, they're all good.
Some of the Canadian researchers are looking at the effectiveness of not just treatment, but treatment along with exchange.
Yep.
Where if you exchange the ballast water and then treat it with these IMO-approved treatment systems, you might be able to come very close, or actually reach the current proposed Coast Guard standard of 100 times or 1,000 times IMO. So it's looking more and more likely all the time. If as Mark mentioned, uncertainty is the biggest thing. You're asking these companies to invest millions of dollars in these treatment systems to treat their ballast, but we have this wavery, this nebulous standard out there, and until the standard is set, it's difficult to justify that kind of expenditure.
Yeah, real quick.
Yes, you talked about the two species, mussels and Asian carp. What else, what other invaders are already either in the system or do arrive that might have a significant impact on ecology, even the Great Lakes?
Well,
the next one.
That's you.
That's me. Well, I did, that was my part of my doctoral research, was predicting potential fish invaders in the Great Lakes. And it was like looking at the characteristics of the fish that became established and compare those to the fish that were introduced and failed to become established. And then we made this model, and then we tested it, or tried to find some potential invaders from Eurasia that might come in ballast water. And we identified 5 fish. This came out in Science in 2002 under Kolar and Lodge. And let's see, that was the Tayulka, T-Y-U-L-K-A, which is a shad, the monkey goby, very similar to the round goby that's such a problem here. I know Eurasian minnow was one.
Yeah, a long time ago, perch. Wasn't it?
It was, yeah, a while. So the perch was the fourth, and I'm not remembering the fifth one off the top of my head. None of those, thankfully, have come here, so hopefully I'm always wrong because they'll never get here. There hasn't been a fish to become established since then, though. So as far as I know, that's the only predictions that are made about fish, anyway.
Yeah, those are just the fish. I mean, there's a lot of other critters besides fish. But so there is a researcher in Canada, Tony Ricciardi, who's written a lot about this. This is his specialty. He was invited to come here and couldn't make it for schedule conflict reasons, but if you want to look up his name, Ricciardi, he's done some research sort of predicting what species are in Europe and Eurasia that likely could survive and do well in the Great Lakes if they get here, which is why the prevention aspect of trying to treat this ballast water is so important, so that we don't have continued insults, as Phil said, to the system every year or two or three, even though we seem to be making a little bit of progress. But I want to thank the panel for being here and let you all get to lunch. They'll hang around for a few minutes.